John 18. You know, this is always read, of course, during Holy Week. It's read anytime the Passion of the Lord is read. And they use John's version a lot. But, so if you've, and I know it's not true with you guys, but if anybody reads this chapter and says, I never heard anything like this before, then I don't know what, I don't even know what to say about that. Because this is kind of like the typical, the whole climax of why Jesus came. This is the whole climax of everything that started in Genesis 3:15 and came to this moment, and everything that started with all the symbols and shadows and the Torah and all the prophetic writings, and everything pointed to this day. And for what we do, you know, they looked, all those things in Scripture pointed to the cross. We look back at the cross because the cross is the center. And, you know, like I always say, if you don't think about the cross 20 times a day, you don't get what happened there. And I don't know why you'd want to think about anything else. People say, what do you do on Good Friday? I don't know. Every day is Good Friday. Every day is Easter. Every day is Christmas. Every day is all the stuff. Because it's all so overwhelming that you think about it all the time. So we went through all these chapters where they actually all, these last few chapters actually all take place at the Last Supper. It's actually one long discourse. And, you know, remember, John is like sitting right next to him, which is probably true. It doesn't say John was sitting right next to him, but, you know, all the pictures are depicted that way. You know, at one point he leans against him, and, I mean, he heard everything that he said. I mean, he wasn't like, you know, 50 rows back going, what did he say? What was that again? So he hears all this, and, you know, of course, under inspiration of the Spirit, because he writes it down later. He didn't write it down that day. I mean, he didn't go home and say, I better write that all down because someday it's going to be important. But like Jesus himself said, when the paraclete comes, when the other comforter comes, he's going to remind you of what I said. And then imagine after months or years, you don't remember it. And of course, he knew this was going to happen. So he said, the Spirit will remind you of everything I said. And so now, after all those chapters telling about the Spirit, telling who he was, how he was one with the Father, how, you know, he heard the Father say to do. He only did what he heard the Father say and so forth. Now comes the final moment, the final. And remember, it's now Passover, because that what we would call Thursday night at sundown began Friday. So the Last Supper was actually early on Friday, because as soon as the sun goes down, you do the Seder. So that's Friday. And that Friday was the Passover. The following day was a very important Sabbath, because it was the Sabbath right after Passover within the Feast of Unleavened Bread. It's a very important Sabbath. So there was a lot of stuff going on. And by tradition, they had added things later on Passover Day that they did as kind of the continuing celebration. You had the Seder, and then the next day you had what we would call prayer services, and, you know, you kind of commemorated the Passover longer because it's such a huge deal. And why is the Passover a huge deal? Because it's about lambs and it's about blood and it's about curses. So if you have the blood of the lamb, you're freed from the curse. If you don't have the blood of the lamb, you got the curse. It's salvation history. And eventually tradition even became that they would do a second Seder when it got to be sundown Friday night, so that it would actually be the start of the Sabbath. They would do another Seder, which some Jewish families still do. That was Passover Day. And of course, he had to die at Passover. lamb, blood, then all the feasts have to be fulfilled. And he goes into the tomb. It's then when the sun goes down, it's the Feast of Unleavened Bread. The way things ended up that year, the resurrection day, Easter Sunday was the Feast of First Fruits. So he fulfills all three of those feasts in like 48 hours of time, less than. I mean, because the resurrection could happen any time after sundown on Saturday, because then it would have been Sunday. Not to mention prophecies of Isaiah, you know, it's going to suffer, you won't even recognize him, it's going to have stripes, it's going to die, you're going to be healed because of the stripes, he's going to be put in a tomb that isn't his, he's going to be buried with sinners. And we think the Old Testament's boring. He had to rise on the third day because the Psalm of, you know, he won't allow his Holy One to see corruption. The Jews believed that bodies started to decompose on the fourth day after death, which, of course, isn't true. Start to decompose immediately. So that's why he waited till the fourth day to get to where Lazarus was. He did that purposely. So there was no question he was dead, and that's why the sister says, oh, there's going to be a stench when they roll the rock away. And that's why he had to rise on the third day. So all this stuff, you know, just all comes together. But as we, I mean, we should read this. We all know this pretty much by heart. But it's, the first point here is Jesus decides the time when this is going to happen. This has all been set forth. You know, everything God does is at an appointed time. The feast days are called Moedim. That means appointed times. You can't just celebrate the feast days any old day you feel like doing it. You know, it gives you a specific first day of the month. You know, 10 days later you do this. 5 days after that you do this. But appointed times. Remember after the synagogue at Nazareth, they were going to kill him. But he just walked right through them because he knew it wasn't his time yet. At the one time at the temple, they accused him of blasphemy. They picked up stones to stone him. He just said, no, it's not going to happen now. I mean, he didn't say that, but he knew it wasn't going to happen then. Now he knows it's going to happen because this is the appointed time. And it's Passover, and he's eaten the Seder. So this is it. So now he becomes the Lamb, capital L. It's interesting that when the Seder's over, he leaves the city. There's no documentation that he ever stayed overnight in Jerusalem. I'm not sure all the ramifications of that, but that would be an interesting study to do because he always leaves, goes to the Mount of Olives, comes back, leaves, comes back. He doesn't spend the vast majority of his time in Galilee and spends very little time in Jerusalem if you add up all the events. And that's, you know, of course, the holy city and the temple is there. And, of course, he is greater than the temple and greater than all those things. I think it's probably, we should read this, right? Yeah. You know, somebody start, anybody who wants to read it, if you want to read the whole chapter or parts of it.
When he had said this, Jesus went out with his disciples across the Kidron Valley to where there was a garden into which he and his disciples entered. Judas, his betrayer, also knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So Judas got a band of soldiers and guards from the chief priests and the Pharisees and went there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Jesus, knowing everything that was going to happen to him, went out and said to them, "Whom are you looking for?" They answered, "Him, Jesus the Nazarene." He said to them, "I am." Judas, his betrayer, was also with them. When he said to them, "I am," they turned away and fell to the ground. So he again asked them, "Whom are you looking for?" They said, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus answered, "I told you that I am. So if you are looking for me, let these men go." This was to fulfill what he had said, "I have not lost any of those you gave me." Then Simon Peter, who had a sword, drew it, struck the high priest's slave, and cut off his right ear. The slave's name was Malchus. Jesus said to Peter, "Put your sword into the scabbard. Shall I not drink the cup that the Father gave me?" So the band of soldiers, the tribune, and the Jewish guards seized Jesus, bound him, and brought him to Annas first. He was the father-in-law of Caiaphas, who was high priest that year. It was Caiaphas who had counseled the Jews that it was better than one man should die rather than the people. Should I keep going? Simon Peter and another disciple followed Jesus. Now the other disciple was known to the high priest, and he entered the courtyard of the high priest with Jesus. Peter stood at the gate outside. So the other disciples, the acquaintance of the high priest, went out and spoke to the gatekeeper and brought Peter in. Then the maid who was the gatekeeper said to Peter, You are not one of this man's disciples, are you? He said, I am not. Now the slaves and the guards were standing around a charcoal fire that they had made because it was cold and were warming themselves. Peter was also standing there keeping warm. The high priest questioned Jesus about his disciples and about his doctrine. Jesus answered him, I have spoken publicly to the world. I have always taught in a synagogue or in the temple area where all the Jews gather, and in secret I have said nothing. Why ask me? Ask those who heard me what I said to them. They know what I said. When he said this, one of the temple guards standing there struck Jesus and said, Is this the way you answer the high priest? Jesus answered him, If I have spoken wrongly, testify to the wrong. But if I have spoken rightly, why do you strike me? Then Annas sent him about to Caiaphas, the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing there, keeping warm. And they said to him, You are not one of the disciples, are you? He denied it and said, I am not. One of the slaves of the high priest, a relative of the one whose ear Peter had cut off, said, Didn't I see you in the garden with him? Again, Peter denied it. And immediately the cock crowed. Then they brought Jesus from Caiaphas to the praetorium. It was morning, and they themselves did not enter the praetorium in order not to be defiled so that they could eat the Passover. So Pilate came out to them and said, What charge do you bring against this man? They answered and said to him, If he were not a criminal, we would not have handed him over to you. At this, Pilate said to them, Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law. The Jews answered him, We do not have the right to execute anyone in order that the word of Jesus might be fulfilled that he said, indicating that kind of death he would die. So Pilate went back into the praetorium and summoned Jesus and said to him, Are you the king of the Jews? Jesus answered, Do you say this on your own, or have others told you about me? Pilate answered, I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and the chief priests handed you over to me. What have you done? Jesus answered, My kingdom does not belong to this world. If my kingdom did belong to this world, my attendants would be fighting to keep me from being handed over to the Jews. But as it is, my kingdom is not here. So Pilate said to him, Then you are a king. Jesus answered, You say I am a king. For this I was born, and for this I came into the world, to testify to the truth. Everyone who belongs to the truth listens to my voice. Pilate said to him, What is the truth? When he said this, he again went out to the Jews and said to them, I find no guilt in him. But you have a custom that I have released one prisoner to you at Passover. Do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews? They cried out again, Not this one, but Barabbas. Now Barabbas was a revolutionary.
That's the perfect example of legalism. In other words, we can't step there because we'll be defiled and then we can't eat the food. But we want this guy killed. You know, it's like, we don't want to break the law, but can you kill this guy?
We don't have a law that we can...
The third cup, they don't have a fourth cup, and we know this, we'll do this again at the Seder. So they sing the Psalms, which are the Hallel Psalms, and they leave. And if you go from where the upper room is felt to be, which the upper room that is there now, of course, is not the original because it's got Crusader arches. And then later it became a mosque when the Ottomans came. The upper room was probably there. To walk to Gethsemane, it's a good long walk. It's probably a couple of miles. It would have been late at night. They would have eaten a big meal. They would have had three full cups of wine. And, you know, it's no wonder they fell asleep. So when he says, you know, I'm going to go there and pray, you guys just say, okay, yeah, yeah, okay. Yeah, you go over there and pray. We're just going to kind of... They'd be asleep. As probably all of us would, after you eat all that food and drink all that wine. So it's a good, probably a mile and a half to 2 mile walk. And you have to go, it's the Kidron Valley. It's named after the Kidron, the brook Kidron, the Kidron Little River that is at the bottom of this valley. But it's not like the Grand Canyon. You're going to walk across it, and you're going to walk across the little stream. Mm-hmm. The Kidron, it means black brook. So black brook, dark black is what the name means. So, you know, we know in... it might not be a bad idea to look up some of these psalms. So, you know, when David is fleeing from Absalom, his son, in 2 Samuel, you know, he goes up the Mount of Olives. He stops and drinks out of the Kidron Valley, a brook, and then he goes up the Mount of Olives weeping.
The bridge over the brook Kidron, watching Holy Week unfold.
It doesn't say...
He drinks from the brook by the wayside and thus holds high the head, which is a different, maybe, translation.
Yeah, because the one, what I read... When I made the handout, was that he drinks from the brook and he looks up. So the this commentator was speculating that in order to keep all that consistent, and since Jesus is the son of David, maybe he stopped and drank from the brook and looked up to where he was going to go. But we don't know that for sure. But in 2 Chronicles, hope that I didn't do that one wrong too. They cast abominable idols into the Kidron. So it had kind of a, you know, black, dirty reputation. And interestingly, he goes to a garden. You know, like I always say, all of salvation history is about two gardens and two trees. The first garden is a beautiful garden with a beautiful tree. The second garden is a horrible, oppressive place. And the second tree, of course, is the cross. So the first garden brought death, and the second garden and tree bring life. So he goes to a garden. You know, you have Eden and you have Gethsemane, and contrasts, sharp, stark contrast, I should say. So his suffering begins in a garden. I mean, he hasn't suffered yet. I mean, so far it says he knows what's going to happen, which, of course, involves anxiety and some suffering. But when he gets into the garden, he starts to really suffer because, gets into these passages from Isaiah 51 that talk about Israel has to drink the cup of judgment, and the cup is the dregs and gross stuff, and you have to drink it. And then a verse or two later, it says, I'm going to take the cup from you so that you don't have to drink it.
Where is that?
Isaiah 51. Generally from 17 to 22. So this is the cup he's talking about drinking. It's the cup of judgment. It's not another cup of wine. It's not a cup of water. So he says, Father, you know, if this cup can pass from me, because the cup is, it's a scary, disgusting thing. When you look into the cup, it's not good. He can't have that. He doesn't want to drink that cup. And in his humanity, he even says, you know what, if there's a way, another way we can do this, I don't want to drink this cup, but I have to do your will. And so the cup that we're supposed to drink, he drinks. Actually, more than drinks, it gets poured on him. And so this happens in the garden in stark contrast. And then, you know, suffering starts there, and then he's also buried in a garden. So there's references to gardens in both of those things. And then this band of soldiers come, and what, you know, and I was thinking about this when I was typing this out and putting down wrong references. I was thinking, you know, a band of soldiers come. He's there basically with Peter, James, and John that we know of. We don't know where the other guys, if the other guys were close by or where they were. But he's there with like his closest friends. Judas, of course, has already left and is already with this band. But this band of soldiers comes. So he's got few friends, a lot of enemies. Few friends, a lot of enemies, like us, you know. If the world hates you, know that it hated me first. Right? So the logical thing to think is, if everybody loves you, then something's wrong. You must be like the world. Because the world loves what's its own. And boy, we really see that go on in our time. Yeah. You try to be, you know, you say anything and get canceled or get called narrow-minded, bigoted, homophobic, whatever. And, I mean, it's any, you know, who are you to say, blah, blah, blah. So this band of people come, and this is interesting. These are, you know, the temple had guards. There was kind of like a police force that kept order at the temple. Generally, this is also portrayed as Roman soldiers being involved, but I don't know if they were really involved here yet. But it's kind of a combination of civil power and religious power, which is interesting. So the civil government hates them. The religious establishment hates them. You know, in Romans, Paul says, of all the people who should have known he was the Messiah, it should have been those religious leaders. They had all the scriptures. They had all the stuff. They had all the writings. They had all the... And they're the ones that want to kill him. So it's a combination of civil and religious power. Now, Psalm 2, I know I didn't misquote, because Psalm 2 talks about how they plot against the Lord and his anointed. I love this psalm because we can really use it in our time because we can get so discouraged of how things are going on around us. And it is discouraging. You know, I don't care how religious you are, how observant you are. You know, when you see all the stuff going on, it's easy to get discouraged. So Psalm 2 talks about, why do the nations rage and the peoples utter folly? The kings of the earth rise up. The princes conspire together against the Lord and against his anointed. Let us break their fetters and cast their bonds from us. He who is enthroned in heaven laughs. The Lord derides them. Then in anger he speaks to them. He terrifies them in his wrath. I myself have set up my king on Zion, my holy mountain. I will proclaim the decree of the Lord. The Lord said to me, you are my son. This day I have begotten you. Ask of me and I will give you the nations for an inheritance, the ends of the earth for your possession. You shall rule them with an iron rod and shall shatter them like an earthen dish. Ooh. So these guys are plotting against the Lord and his anointed. You know, after all, Messiah, Christ means the anointed one. They're conspiring, they're plotting against him. But he's the king who's enthroned on Zion. It's futile. And of course, you know, we can't look at this as, gee, Jesus was such a good man, and he was such a good philosopher, and he was such a good moral teacher, and it's too bad they killed him. Because that's how you tend to look at it if you don't know that he had to die. This was just the mechanism that did it. He didn't hide like the first Adam did. He presents himself to be sacrificed. He presents himself to be killed. And he says, who are you looking for? And here I am. You know, the first Adam, when he was confronted, he ran away and hid. Where'd that Adam go? I know he's around here somewhere. So, you know, he's not like the first Adam. And he knew what was happening. And then they call him Jesus of Nazareth because that's how he was known. So that's why, like, when Pentecost morning, when Peter preaches this great sermon, he calls him Jesus of Nazareth because that's how he was known. There were lots of people named Yeshua, but he was known as Yeshua Nazareth, Jesus of Nazareth. So everybody knew who Peter was talking about. Just like when God says, I'm the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, everybody knows who's talking. It's not some Egyptian god. It's not some Canaanite god. It's the God of the patriarchs. So they call him. They say they're looking for Jesus of Nazareth. He answers, I am. And this is why they fall down. Because at the name of God, you know, you're supposed to fall down. So when he answers, I am, they fall down. And this, again, like we were talking about, and it's like we were talking about Joseph. You know, Joseph reveals himself and says, I'm Joseph. And the brothers fall down. They sold Joseph for silver, 20 pieces, not 30 pieces, but they sold him for silver coins, and Judas collected silver coins. You know, they got rid of Joseph by having the Gentiles dispose of him. Yeah, you guys take him. These guys used the Gentiles to kill Jesus. We don't want to, you guys got to do this. So all these things that were types and shadows and foretellings in Torah, particularly about Joseph, are all fulfilled. And because he's the son of David, so many things from the Psalms, of course, are fulfilled also. Because David, when he writes these beautiful Psalms, some of it's about him, but some of it's about Messiah. Because he knows now that Messiah is going to be related to him. So he tries to protect his friends. Okay, if you're looking for me, then let these guys go. And then, of course, he tells Peter, you know, he's got to drink the cup. And then they bind him and bring him into the city. Now, to get back to the city, they either have to come through the Eastern Gate or what was called the Sheep Gate. So the Sheep Gate is where they brought in sheep, lambs they were going to use for sacrifice and stuff. So maybe they brought him in through the Sheep Gate since he was the lamb. And since he came in on Passover in the Eastern Gate, I mean Palm Sunday on the Eastern Gate, and Palm Sunday was the day that people would have picked out the lamb they were going to use for Passover. So he's the true lamb who presents himself as the Passover lamb, while everybody else is buying their real lamb to have for the Passover. I could hardly even stand it. People say the Old Testament's boring. Yeah, so they seize him. Maybe they brought him in through the Sheep Gate, but this is against all the rules that there were for trial. In the law, as well as in the civil law that they had at the time. You don't just like bind somebody and take them. You know, you got to charge them, you got to take them. You know, there were mechanisms. And of course, Rome, you know, a lot of our laws patterned on Roman law. You know, Roman law was very strict. You didn't just grab somebody and execute them. You had to charge them with a crime, you had to produce witnesses. You know, somebody had to rule, yeah, he's guilty, or no, he's not guilty. And you had, your right as a citizen was, you had to be charged with a crime, you know, the habeas corpus. You can't just randomly arrest somebody, say, I don't like you, so we're going to arrest you. I mean, not that they didn't do it, but yeah, according to the law, you had to be charged with a crime. So they violated that. The law says you never try anybody during the night because trials have to be public. Well, it's probably 1, 2 a.m. by this time, depending how long it took them to eat, how long it took them to walk to the garden and had to walk back into the city. So it's probably 2 or 3 a.m., who knows? But obviously, the trial's happening during the night. According to the law of Moses, you have to produce 2 or 3 witnesses. So this is why these guys are trying to produce witnesses. You know, middle of the night, you know, we got to go find some witnesses. Yeah, I heard him say, you know. And it's interesting, they ask him about his teaching. They ask him about his doctrine. They've already condemned him for it. But now they say, okay, so what's your teachings? What's your doctrine? They've already condemned him. And he says, hey, people heard what I said. Go find some witnesses. They'll tell you. You know, in Acts, Paul always gets in trouble because people say, oh, he's telling us we don't have to follow the law of Moses. He's putting everything against the law of Moses, and so he doesn't go by, right? So they want to try him all the time. Here, Jesus says to them, well, lots of people heard what I taught, so go find some of them. They can tell you. You bozos weren't listening, but they were. And again, you have to know the ancient languages to find about the bozos. Because, you know, people who heard the teaching, you know, I'm always struck by when you read the parable of the prodigal son, when it starts out, it says that the common people were listening and the religious people were all muttering. What's he talking about? Son going about, you know, what's this guy? What kind of story is this? The ordinary people are like listening, saying, wow, that's really cool. So he says, you know, go find some witnesses. Then also in Isaiah and Micah, it prophesies how he's going to be struck. He's going to be struck in the face. They had rules in their civil law. I understand. I didn't research this independently. But they had rules in their civil law. I don't think it's the law of Moses. And there were Roman law that you don't beat somebody while they're bound. So they violated that as well. And, of course, the Romans did too. But Roman law didn't apply to you if you weren't a Roman citizen. But the idea was if somebody's all tied up, you don't beat them. But anyway, they beat him when he was all tied up. And then this praetorian, a praetor was a Roman official who was in charge of something. So now, you know, Pilate was the governor of the whole region. So he was like the ultimate praetor, and the praetorium was where he worked. The Romans hated Jerusalem. They hated the people there. And so most of the time they stayed in Caesarea Maritima, which was nice. On the ocean, all Roman, there was a Roman city. They were happy as clams over there. And then during the holy days, especially Passover, which was one of the pilgrimage feasts, Pilate and the military people would go to the city because there'd always be like some kind of pandemonium going on. And plus the population of the city was huge during the pilgrimage feasts. But they hated Jerusalem. Just like in The Chosen, where Quintus says, oh, the grapes are great, the figs are great, the pomegranates are great, but the people. And interesting, and the thing too, the Romans hated being there, so when they did crucifixions, they were disgusting, because it was like their entertainment. So it's, oh, good. You know, we got 3 guys to crucify today. You know, at least we'll have something to do today instead of walking around. And you know the culture of the gladiators, the Colosseum, and the Colosseum wasn't built yet, but the same, they had the games. So, you know, brutalizing somebody and killing them was like, you know, that's like us watching Super Bowl. So the Praetorium is this place where the governor also judged cases like this. But of course, for the religious leaders, they would be defiled if they went to the Gentile place. Walked on the stones, touched a Gentile. Because you're not supposed to have anything to do with them. You're supposed to be separate from them. So they didn't want to, they're talking to Pilate across the, you know, like a plaza. They're not like standing next to Pilate talking. So, and you can see here, there's a private part of it and a public part of it, because he takes Jesus into a private room and says, so are you a king? You know, he doesn't do that in front of a crowd. And then, you know, he brings them back out. And so then, you know, John doesn't talk about it, but when he, the other accounts, he probably figures, well, if he whips them a little bit, the people will be happy with that, and then he'll let him go. And he didn't realize what was going to happen. Because they weren't limited by the 39 lashes that the Jews had. I mean, they thought this was fun. I mean, if the Shroud of Turin is Jesus, there's up to 200 lashes, depending how you count them. And he was whipped by two people, a tall man and a short man, just the way the lashes are arranged. And there's none on his arms. So he might have been tied like this, or tied like that. I don't know. I don't remember how the possible things. So again, you know, It's kind of like Joseph, you know. We're going to have the Gentiles get rid of him, and then we don't have to worry about it. So, you know, Pilate asks, what's the crime? Because he's used to Roman law, okay? What's the crime? Oh, he stole 50,000 shekels. Okay, that's a crime. We can go on with a trial. Or, yeah, he killed a guy. Oh, okay, well, then let's get the witnesses and let's... So what's the crime?
A criminal, we wouldn't have brought
him. That's right. And Pilate's not impressed with the law of Moses. He's like, well, just take care of it yourself. That's who cares? Get to care of it yourself then. But then they say, you know, we can't put somebody to death. Now, strictly, when the Romans were in charge of that, they were the only ones who could execute, and the locals weren't. But then they stoned Stephen, you know, and Acts 7, but that was kind of like a passion thing. They all ran at him and killed him. And so the Romans took care of execution. They weren't allowed to execute. So that's why they said, well, you guys got to do it because we can't do it. And this, of course, also fulfills, and it's been for a while, because after the people came back from Babylon, there were no more kings. There were no kings. So it was a, you know, 500-year, 400-and-some-year period. But, you know, back in Genesis 49, Jacob said, you know, Judah is going to have the scepter, but there's going to be a time when the scepter is going to be gone. So they weren't ruling anymore. Somebody else, you know, the Romans were ruling the Greeks before them and miscellaneous other people before them, Babylonians, Persians. So they did not have a law that they could enforce because they always had people above them. So the Romans were the only ones that could fulfill the prophecies that Messiah had to suffer and die and be pierced. You know, Isaiah talks about he's pierced. Jews never pierced anybody. They stoned you. Piercing was, you know, something pagans did. But then, and then, you know, 500 years before this, Zechariah says they'll look on him whom they've pierced. In Isaiah's description, too, there was no crucifixion at that time, 700 years before Jesus. Crucifixion came, of course, into the land with the Romans, and everybody who lived then would have been familiar with crosses because they saw it all the time. Somebody was convicted of murder, the Romans crucified him. You know, somebody committed some major crime, crucified him. And then they put, you know, the crime on top of the cross. This guy killed a Roman soldier. So when you walked by and you said, this guy killed a Roman soldier, and you saw this poor guy going, you'd say, ooh, made an impression on you. So everybody knew about this. So this is why, you know, when he says things like, take up your cross and follow me, we say, oh, yeah, right there. To them, it would have been like, what? Take up a cross? When you saw somebody walking down the road carrying a cross with a couple of soldiers with them, one thing you knew is you weren't going to see that guy anymore. They're going to put him up on that thing, and he may live for a while. He may even live till the next day, but he's not going to be skipping back into town. So when he says, pick up your cross, I mean, this is like, that doesn't hit us like it would have hit them. He's pierced. And so, you know, it's interesting, this interaction between Jesus and Pilate. You know, Pilate treats him with more respect than the religious people did. Because he seems to be interested in, like, well, who are you? You're a king? Truth? What's truth? I mean, you have truth with a capital T, you have truth with a little t. And, you know, there's truth with a capital T. I mean, he could have said, I'm truth with a capital T, and that's what I'm here to talk about. But Pilate kind of, you know, he's too weak, really, to say, all right, just leave this guy alone. That's my verdict. You know, and if you're going to harass him anymore, then you're going to get arrested. But he doesn't do that. He just kind of, I wash my hands of this, do what you want to do. And then he has his people do it, which is, he doesn't want a riot on his hands. I mean, when you've been a judge over, you know, hundreds of criminals, there's probably some that stand out. I mean, would he have gone away? This is like really stands out. This man's not your garden variety criminal. So he's kind of too weak to stop it. But then there's this Barabbas business. That's fascinating too. I mean, on the regular level, on the kind of normal earthly level, people are so angry, you know, they'll let the murderer and revolutionary go free because they really want this guy killed. So two interesting things about Barabbas. His name, Barabbas, means son of the father. So think of that. You have a guy whose name means son of the father, and you have the son of the father standing there before Pilate. Isn't that amazing? Even his name is... It son of the father and the true son of the father, both standing in front of Pilate. It's a powerful thing. And it also even harkens back to Yom Kippur with the scapegoat. We have two goats come in front of the priest, and he draws lots, and, you know, the one goat is sacrificed, the other goat is let go. Here you have two people standing in front, not of the high priest, but standing in front of the highest civil official. One's let go and the other one's killed. So it even kind of fulfills that in a, I don't know, you might say non-religious way. But it's pretty amazing. The Azazel, the scapegoat. And the one goat dies, the other goat gets, of course, left out in the wilderness. And because it's now Barabbas didn't symbolize this, but the scapegoat symbolized sin is removed from the community and banished into the wilderness. And the goat that was sacrificed, of course, is part of the blood that goes into the Holy of Holies. And this is why the cross had to be outside of the city, because sin has to be outside of the camp. But I don't know this Barabbas character. I don't know how much is known about him, probably not a lot. I don't think they kept court records of every criminal and every, I don't know. So even though that's a chapter that we all know and we're all going to hear about it soon, there's a lot of things to it. And again, I always keep in mind that we know the story, that we've heard this read so many times over the course of our life. And yeah, we know the story. But when you're living it in real time and you're Peter or you're, you know, Pilate or you're, and all this is happening, you know, you don't always say, oh, well, wait a minute. Oh, I see what this means. This is all this stuff is going on all around you, and it's happening fast. You know, the real time kind of thing. And then it's like when, and of course we'll do the other thing next time, but when, you know, when these guys all go home that night, now these religious guys presumably went to wherever they were going and they had their prayer meeting, they had their food that was left over. Some of them even had a second Seder. They said, oh good, we didn't step in the Praetorium, so we're not defiled, so we can have the prayer meeting. Oh yeah, we killed the guy, but that's okay.
We didn't kill him.
Yeah, we didn't kill him. That's right. We did. We hired somebody to do it. You know, so they went home and probably went about their business. You know, Peter and the other apostles would have been like, you know, how would you have spent that night and the next day? I mean, I can't even imagine.